Well, good morning. I got a new title in the middle of Ed's prayer, Preacher of the Hour. So I didn't quite know I was going to get that, Ed. All right, before all of you get too comfortable, we're going to do something I know you absolutely despise, because we're going to do something a little bit different today. This is more in the nature of a conversational or congregational meeting discussion, so everybody move as close as you can to the center. And look, I left the whole pew. Kathy's not here. And if it's too busy, you can sit on the sides over here. And look, some people are meeting someone for the first time. And Isaac is blocking Ashley's view. And
she knows what you look like.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate everyone doing that. The reason for that is, I mean, studies actually show that when people are closer together, you learn better. I don't know who did that study. I read it somewhere, and it made sense to me. So if you're visiting with us, you are probably wondering what in the world is going on. The person who doesn't normally speak is, and now they have made me move in the middle of services. The reason for this is we typically, at the beginning of the new year, sit and have a discussion about what the goals are for the upcoming year. So normally we would have done this 2 or 3 weeks from now. But in a meeting that Dwayne and Sandy and I had a few weeks ago, we thought it made sense to kind of outline some of the plans for the congregation to get your input even before that new year began. And so that's what we're going to be doing today. And I want to go ahead and share with you quickly the theme for the year, and it's a better 2017, which, depending on your viewpoint, can be a very pessimistic view, a very optimistic view, but I hope it will be for all of you a very realistic view. The pessimist says, well, wait a minute, why does 2017 have to be better than 2016? Was there something wrong with 2016? The optimist would say, well, everything can always be better in a following year, so let's have a better year. The realist would say, there are some things that we need to talk about and address, and so that's largely the view that I'm going to be taking today. But I hope you will take it in whatever spirit in which you find it the most fitting for you. Either pessimistically, that things maybe haven't been as all they should have been. Optimistically, that things can be better, which I hope is a view that we can all take. Or realistically, understanding exactly where it is we are. 2016, I don't know about for you, but for certainly for Kathy and I, it has been an interesting year, and one that, frankly, we would just prefer be left in the rearview mirror, to be perfectly blunt about it, for a variety of reasons. She sent me a text last night. How many of you saw the movie Titanic? Okay, everybody remember Kate Winslet was the lead character in Titanic, and if you recall, in the bulk of the movie, Kate Winslet is playing a character who was the age of Kate Winslet at the time, who was, you know, early 20s or something like that. But in reality, the character that she was playing was someone who survived the sinking of the Titanic. And if you recall, at the beginning and the end of the movie, they showed, I don't even know the actress's name, a much elderly woman, someone who had aged 84 years from the time of the sinking of the Titanic. And they showed, the text that Kathy sent me had a picture of the young Kate Winslet and the character at the very end. And the bottom of the caption said, this is the way I feel after 2016, that aging which has occurred. And so when I was reading the Washington Post this morning, this was one of the headline articles. It said, by many accounts, 2016 has been one of the worst years in history. One calamity after another, John Oliver labeled it, citing Syria, Zika, and celebrity deaths. Over at Slate, historians argued that to look at 2016, we must put it in context. At least it wasn't 72,000 BC when many humans came close to extinction. But for some people, 2016 was truly a disaster. I don't know how you feel about that, and I kind of read that just to almost for shock value. But let me read you a list of names. You tell me what's in common with this list of names. John Glenn, Nancy Reagan, Prince, Antonin Scalia, Fidel Castro, Florence Henderson, for those of you who don't know, was Mrs. Brady on the Brady Bunch. Denton Cooley, the first person to ever perform a heart transplant surgery. Gwen Ifill of PBS News. Leonard Cohen, Janet Reno, Arnold Palmer, W.P. Kinsella, who wrote the movie The Field of Dreams. Gene Wilder. What does everybody know Gene Wilder as?
Yeah.
Willy Wonka, right? Kenny Baker, the man who played R2-D2 in Star Wars. And Gary Marshall, who gave us such things as Laverne and Shirley in Happy Days. What's the commonality of all of that? They all passed away in 2016. And, you know, every year there is a lot of notable deaths, and 2016 is really no different. It just struck me that those were a lot of people that I kind of knew, and not personally, but, you know, knew of growing up. And certainly we've experienced loss. We think of John Ferguson. I remember that I think Ed was gone one Sunday, and I was taking attendance, and I instinctively looked right there where Connie, the vacancy next to Connie, because that's where John always sat. It was the first time it kind of hit me that that death had occurred. Not that I wasn't aware of it already, but it struck me on that. So as we think about 2016, the reason for giving you all of that is to say we need to honestly and realistically assess where we are as a congregation and then look forward of where we want to go. I want to show you a picture here. Does anybody know what that picture is? Okay. It is the walls of Jerusalem. And there's lots of discussion in the Bible about those walls. I don't know exactly when the very first wall began. The various commentators I was reading said it could have begun in about 931 B.C. It maybe continued in building up until 586 B.C. I'm not quite sure. But the point of it is, in 2 Chronicles, talks about how King Hezekiah began building a wall, but you see around that city that complete walls were built. And at the time those complete walls were built, the city stood as firm and as entrenched and as, frankly, powerful as it was going to be during its time. This is a depiction that somebody just said, you know, maybe that's what it looked like. And you see there the towers of those walls where the people could look out. And just think about how intricate that would be without the benefit of modern machinery, building a wall. I don't know how they lifted up one stone upon the other. Let me show you a picture here. What is that? That's a depiction, perhaps, of the walls of Jerusalem at a time that they needed to be rebuilt. When we look at the book of Nehemiah, which is one of my favorite, we have, Nehemiah is thought to have written the book and begun, gone into the city about 445 B.C. This is at the period of time after which the people had gone into Babylonian captivity in 586, and King Cyrus comes and declares that they're going to be freed, and ultimately the people are freed from that captivity, but what they returned to was not what they left. Wasn't that they came back to. It was something like this. In the book of Nehemiah, is Nehemiah talking about the need to rebuild the walls. And he spends all of the book talking about motivating the people to rebuild the walls and what was necessary to rebuild the walls, either anything down from the labor that it took and the various craftsmen that it was going to take to the contribution that was necessary to rebuild the walls. But the one thing that was immutable, the one thing that was not going to be compromised on, was Nehemiah and the people were going to rebuild that wall. And in fact, if you look at the third and the fourth chapter, I believe it is, the speed with which the wall was built was amazing by any construction standards. And it was a testament more toward the people being motivated to do it than what was actually done. So why am I telling you about Nehemiah? And why am I showing you these pictures of rebuilding walls? Look around us. The walls are not crumbling. And I'm not about to suggest they are. We moved into this building 9 years ago. It was in February of 2008, so nearly 9 years ago. And we have been blessed to be in this building. So much was done to get us into this building. The contributions that were made, and not just money, but time and effort. If you were here at the time, you recall people coming here Saturday after Saturday after Saturday, painting, cleaning, carpeting, painting murals on the wall. It was really, to me, a great and exciting time because something we were doing something very tangible, and it was easy to look at and be done. And yet, as we look around, if you were here at that time, you will notice that there were a lot of people who were here then who were no longer here. not just by virtue of death or moving away, but by natural aging. I look at my own pew. My girls were here then. They're not now. They live far away. I look at Toogie. She's now married, and she's not gone, or she's gone, and, you know, Drake and Darian are soon, or have been gone, and will be gone. You know, kids grow up. Things like that happen. Change occurs, sometime for the better, sometime for the worse. What I want to suggest to us is that we are in a state where it's time to rebuild the walls. Now, before I go any further, I don't want to predict that anything is, you know, that it's a dire prediction or anything like that. It's frankly, being gloom and doom is the easiest thing in the world to do. Offering the solution is a hard thing to do. And hopefully you will view it in that. But candidly, and I should have done this before I separated, look at where you normally sit, or think about normally where you sit. And look to your right or left. Are there people that you used to normally sit by that are no longer here? And I mean, seriously, think about that. Why? Now, again, things happen. People move. Jobs change. Death occurs. All of those things. But are there things that have happened that have caused people to leave that we have not replaced? And this isn't just about numbers. If it were about numbers, frankly, we could go hire people to come and fill the building every day. I'm being facetious, but this isn't about numbers. This is about people that we care about. This is about people that we want to be here. This is about people that need to be here, as Jimmy talked about, and he's going to talk about even more next week. It's time to rebuild the walls, not only numerically, but I would suggest even spiritually and enthusiastically. I've been reading this book somewhat in preparation for today, but it's written by a preacher of a Church of Christ in Nashville, and he's arguing of things that need to be done to revitalize churches. To whatever extent that we feel there's some rebuilding needs to be done, we're not alone in that, because this guy's written a whole book about it. But in the very first couple of pages of the book, you come across this quote: "Our numbers are in decline, and every week in America, a Church of Christ closes its doors forever." That ought to scare us, because it's true. If you read the United States Census, we are a declining population, not just we and the members of the Church of Christ, but frankly, all religious organizations. But it's true that this is occurring. And what I want us to think very seriously and soberly about, not that our doors are about to close, but don't think that we are immune from this trend. We are not. You know, institutions remain vital because people choose them to remain vital. Otherwise, an institution, whether it be a church, a business, a social organization, if it's not motivated, if it's not actively seeking to grow, it's going to happen just the way it happens to every other organization. It slowly withers, and then ultimately it dies. And when it does, people look around and go, "Well, what happened?" So I don't want that to happen to us. And again, I'm not suggesting we're anywhere near that point, but I am suggesting that we have to look seriously and soberly about it. So it's a time to think about it. I want us to think about our own worship service. If you came here this morning and I asked you before you got here to write down basically what was going to occur, think you could all do it? Sure you could. You've been here. You know, you could probably get, if I said put a timeline next to it, you know, at what point the announcements are going to be made, you know, that's going to occur at 10:32, and what point the prayer is going to be given, that's going to be at 10:35, and then, you know, you could list it down, and then probably we're all going, "Well, I hope that the ending time is real soon," or something. Is that how we think of worship? Do we think of it in terms of attitude, which these two verses here talk about, that God is a spirit and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth? Or Romans 12, that we are to present our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship? Do we think about it as attitude of how and why we worship? Or are we to think about it by function, that we are to pray, that we are to sing, that we are going to have the Lord's Supper as we've just done, that we're going to teach as we're trying to do now, and that we're going to give? All of those are biblical. We should do those things. I am not suggesting otherwise. What I am questioning, and when I say that, I mean personally, am I doing it as a matter of attitude or as a matter of function? Because if it's a matter of function, it becomes in a matter of a pilot's checklist. That I get my checklist out, and I make sure I put a check besides every one, and then when I get to the bottom of that checklist, I know I'm done without regard to why or how I've done it. The only thing that matters is that I completed my checklist. I hope that we're doing our worship as a matter of attitude more so than a matter of function. Both have to work together, but I would argue that without the attitude, function is just form only, and there's really nothing behind that. So, we have to ask ourselves, and it's a fair question, am I better off for having worshiped? I often think about this when I go to a movie. You know, you go to a movie, and putting aside the money that you spend to go to the movie, or if you're watching at home on Netflix or something, I'm about to devote 2 hours of my life to concentrated attention on this particular thing. Think about it in the context of all the other things that you could have done with those 2 hours. And I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with going to movies. Heaven knows I watch a ton of them. You know, but ask yourself the question at the end. You know, was it worth it? Was it worth me having spent that time and maybe even the money for doing it? I started some movie on Netflix last night called Other People. If you've ever watched it, I'm sorry. But it's one of those that about 10 minutes into it, and there was nothing wrong with it, just going, this is an odd plot. About 10 minutes into it, I asked myself the question, do I want to devote 2 hours of my life to this movie? And I decided no. And so I have no idea how the movie finishes, but if it finished like it began, it wasn't worth it. I hope you don't feel that way about your worship service. That when you leave here, you go, you know, I didn't get anything out of that. Or my mind was elsewhere. Or there's something better off I could have otherwise been doing. When we look at Paul's argument in 1 Corinthians 11 through 14, those three chapters, about why it is we are to worship, and he goes there and talks about things like the Lord's Supper, and he talks about things that they were doing, but he concludes as he comes kind of to the end of his discussion, he says, let all things be done for building up. That's what we ought to be, as we do the things that we do as a church, that ought to be the reason that we're doing it. Not egotistically building up, but building up for the good of one another. Building up for the good of the community in which we serve. Building up for the good of the cause of Christ. But all things should be done for building up. Do you see the difference between attitude and function there? Paul in no way is talking in that verse about, you know what, you checked those boxes, good for you. Because, you know, we could get 5 people off the street and tell them what to do, and they've checked the boxes. What Paul says is that we are to do all things done for building up. Hebrews, the writer says, and let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as the day you see drawing near. When we leave this place in just a few minutes, will we be able to say that we have been built up? Will we be able to say that somehow, whether it's because we're all sitting close together now, or something you say to someone at the end, or the prayer that was offered, whatever, that somehow you had stirred up another to love and to good works, that you motivated them to do that, so that at the end, that one another was encouraged. That's what our goal ought to be. And as we look toward 27, I hope that we can keep those things in mind. It's not a matter of function of what we do, it's a matter of the attitude in which we do it, such that when we leave, we will be able to say that we've been built up, we've been stirred up, and we've encouraged one another. So if you have your Bibles, and I know some of you may have left them on your pews when I ask you to move, turn over to the book of Hebrews chapter 6, and we're going to begin in verse 9. This is going to be our theme for the year, and really our question. Yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things, things that belong to salvation. But to really get the full impact of this passage, we need to read 9 through 12. So let me just read that to you. The writer says, though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things, things that belong to salvation. For God is not unjust, so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints as you still do. And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. A couple of phrases in here I think that are so important, and Jimmy's the one that actually keyed me onto this verse here. Verse 10, "For God is not so unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints, as you still do." What that says to me real basically is that God notices. God pays attention to what we do. And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness, to have the full assurance of hope to the end. I don't know if other translations have a different word than earnestness, but it's the idea of activity. It's the idea of being engaged, that we're earnestly involved in this as opposed to passively just clicking along and doing something. So that we may not be sluggish. Let's ask ourselves the question, have we become sluggish? And when I say we, I'm including me and Dwayne and Sandy. Don't think otherwise. We are all including, everyone is in this. Because we want to be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. All of us, I'm sure, can think about individuals that we know who have somehow managed to keep that zeal and fervor and activity for their religious service, and we look at them and admire them and wonder how. The writer is telling us that can be you, and it should be you, and it should be us. So our theme for next year is better. Now that's going to mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. You know, maybe to you it means better if the preacher talks less. I don't know. You know, maybe it means better because when you leave here you have been stirred up and you have been encouraged or you have been built up, whatever it might be to you. So here's just some suggestions that we came up with in terms of how we can be better. And in many respects we ought to just fill in the blank because everybody's going to be different. We can be better in brotherly love. You know, that's going to mean a lot of different things to a lot of people. Maybe brotherly love to you is knowing when to make that phone call to the person who needs the encouragement. Maybe brotherly love is knowing when to bring that meal when someone needs it. You can fill in that blank however you want. We want better assemblies because for the bulk of what we do collectively as a congregation, it is to come together like this. Whether it be done through the singing or the teaching or the classes or the visiting at the end, whatever it might be, we can have better assemblies. It doesn't mean that we're going to have more programmed assemblies, meaning that, you know, everything's going to work at a certain time or anything like that. It's going to be a Hollywood-type production. That's not what I'm meaning. I'm talking about better assemblies so that when we leave, we all feel like we have been stirred up, that we've been encouraged, and that we've been built up. As Jimmy said, he's going to talk about next week and have better evangelism, awareness, and efforts. Remember, the primary, if almost not exclusive, reason we are here is to evangelize. And evangelism is a fancy word for talking to others about Jesus. Remember, that's what the Great Commission was. It was not to see what you could do in a service on a Sunday morning. It was to go out and teach others. You know, better Christ-like living. We all know that being an example is the most powerful lesson any one of us is ever going to teach. And it's something that we do every day, regardless if we think we're teaching or not. An example to your children, an example to your coworkers, an example of people who maybe are visiting here today wondering, what is this congregation doing? And what do they see from us after they leave and think about us? Better service to others. Now, I will submit to you, I think this is one we do pretty well at. So maybe the room for improvement is not as great as in other areas. But service to others really is, I think, where we start showing the distinction between those who merely say and those who actually do. And we all know there's opportunities for service. I have told the story many times since Hurricane Matthew to people that I know, whether it's at my office or people I run into in civic organizations and things, about the Sunday afternoon where a great number of you came out and cut down trees in various people's yards that had fallen. Now, that was not unique in the city of Jacksonville. There was lots of people doing that. But the speed with which people responded here to an immediate need was just impressive. And that's what people told me they thought of our efforts. Not that they were trying to congratulate us, nor were we doing it for congratulation. but it's something we ought to always be aware of, looking for service to others. We're going to talk a moment about better giving, and this is the part of the service that no one likes to talk about, no one likes to hear, but we're going to talk about it bluntly. We need to do better in our giving, and I'll show you why. Better Bible knowledge. We can't hope to teach others convincingly and accurately as we are required to do if we don't have good Bible knowledge, and it's hard. Let's just face it. It's hard. We're reading and learning from texts that were written years ago that require a background and an understanding of history to get its full meaning. It requires us coming and having conversations about often difficult things, trying to understand what does this passage really tell us. And it's easier not to do it. But in order for us to be the Christians that we ought to be, we need to have better Bible knowledge. And no matter how skilled you might be and knowledgeable you might be, I don't think any of us are willing to say, I got it all. We can all do better in that respect. And we need to have better families. And that can mean a lot to, that varies across the thing. But of course, we know that our service to our families is really where it all begins. So how are we going to do this? We talk a lot this year, and it was the theme for 2016 and still is for the next 2 weeks, to find your talent and use it. Some of the words that you use, you know, that becomes a matter of being personally engaged. And I hope that the series of lessons that Jimmy gave about that really touched you, about being personally engaged. Here's what I want to say about that. When people think about being personally engaged in religion, the immediate thing that most people think about is the guy standing up giving a talk. In this case, as Ed says, the preacher of the hour. I will submit to you that that is the least effective teaching that can be done, despite the fact that I'm the one now doing it. We learn and we become engaged by the utilization of our own particular talents. And I want to give you an example of someone in this congregation who will remain unnamed, who made a comment to Jimmy that he told us about that I thought was very moving. It was after the series of lessons, and this individual came up and talked about a recent construction project he had done. I don't know who it was for or necessarily why it was done, but he said, that's the talent that I have, and that's what I can do. Now, as you all know, that would not be something I did. So you can eliminate me from that conversation. Because all of us have different talents, and that's what we were trying to talk about this year, is finding in our talent, using it. If you use your talents, you will feel engaged. If you don't think church means anything to you, maybe it's because you haven't gotten engaged. It doesn't mean you have to be a teacher, although we need them. It doesn't mean you have to be the preacher of the hour or the song leader or whatever, fill in the blank. But it means thinking seriously about whatever it is your particular talent and using it in the way, go back to what we said earlier, that stirs up, builds up, and encourages one another. Jimmy's talked about and already said about Come and See First Sundays, where this is going to be a very concerted and intentional effort to try to bring more people, not just to our services, but to Christ. Again, this is not about building up our numbers. Our numbers will be built up as a byproduct of doing these things. But the Come and See First Sundays. We want to do something we're going to call Service Sundays. And this is going to be, we think, once a quarter. Not quite sure how it's going to work. But what we're going to do is get together like we normally do for a very short service. We're going to pray, sing, teach, have the Lord's Supper, and give. And then we're going to dismiss and hope everybody brought their jeans or whatever. And we're going to go out and do a service project. If somebody's house needs fixing up, we're going to go do it. This is all biblical. We're going to identify those people in need that we can contribute our talents to, more so than just merely inviting someone in. And we'll try to identify what those things are going to be. One of the reasons we wanted to do this is, thinking back again to that example right after the hurricane, I thought the fellowship and the camaraderie and the work together that we found then was more important, what was more active than just by all of us sitting together. And so we're going to look to do this at least once a quarter. This is just for the elders and deacons. We're going to try to be much more focused in our regular meeting together. So deacons, the second Saturday in January, April, July, and October, put on your calendar. We're going to have a formal meeting. As an eldership, we tend to be more casual than what some other congregations are in terms of when we meet and how we meet. Now, we burn up email and phones all the time, but we're going to be very intentional, more intentional this year about working together like that. More offsite opportunities, including in spring and fall, our neighborhood Bible study series, trying to really get out in people's homes where people might feel comfortable in having them come into your homes as opposed to coming here. Just we think it would be more comfortable for people to maybe learn in that. We are going to ask for volunteers to host those. And Jimmy will be talking a lot about that. Now, this next one I introduced to Jimmy, he goes, what are you talking about? You know, the preacher swap. What this is basically say, we can learn a lot by what others do, and they can learn from us. So in June, we've arranged where the preacher at the church, one of the churches in Virginia, is going to come down and spend some time with us, and we're going to learn from him. And I don't mean just we're going to have a gospel meeting or something like that. I mean really come down and contribute his ideas and you know what they're doing, what he's seen in other places that he's preached that we can learn from. And Jimmy's going to go to Virginia and offer our ideas to that congregation. Hopefully both will grow. And Ellen's now looking at me like, what? But hopefully this will work out. We need to pray in a more targeted way. Jack, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but what Jack asked us to pray for today is the way we ought to pray. Specifically with a purpose, knowing that exactly why we are praying, other than filling in the blank that we're supposed to have a prayer at 10:35 in the morning. I know I have told many of you this story before, but the most effective prayer I ever remember was in the little country church where I grew up, where a gentleman that everybody called Uncle Johnny prayed one day. Uncle Johnny never spoke. He was a reserved man would be an understatement. He was about, you know, late 70s. But one day he asked to pray, and it was in the middle of a drought. And remember, I grew up in a farming community. I'm going to quote to you the prayer. Lord, we need rain, and we need it now. Amen. I'm not exaggerating. That was 35, 40 years ago that prayer was offered. Now, I can't tell you if it rained or not, but the point is we need to pray with a purpose. And I thought that's always stuck with me. As we talked about, evangelize in the way you can. But I want you to seriously think about how it is that you can do that. Again, no one's asking someone to do something that they're uncomfortable with, unprepared for, or simply don't want to do. It is to think about how can I be a good evangelist to the people that I come in contact with. And maybe part of that is really taking the next step. If you never taught, make 2017 the year you at least think about doing it and ask about how I can do that. Hartman is hosting a meeting this afternoon at Jimmy Haynes' house to talk about the teaching program and really think about it intentionally as we go into this next quarter. Maybe it is that you are going to start thinking about serving as an elder or a deacon or a song leader. We would like for you to do that, to think about what role can I really do. So the point of all this is doing better is not an aspiration. It needs to be intentional. It needs to be, here's how I am going to contribute to go about in doing this. So now we have to talk about giving. In the latter half, or the latter chapters of Nehemiah, I told you they built up the wall. Nehemiah was very clear in what it would take to rebuild that wall. And I want to read this passage for you. This is an excerpt from chapter 10, verses 32 to 39. Nehemiah says with the people, we also take on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third of a part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. We obligate ourselves to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of all the fruit of every tree year by year to be the house of the Lord. For the people of Israel and the sons of Levi shall bring the contribution of grain, wine, and oil to the chambers where the vessels of the sanctuary are, as well as the priests who minister and the gatekeepers and the singers. We will not neglect the house of God. Obviously, there's a couple of things in there I found particularly pertinent because I underlined and bolded them. Notice that Nehemiah, and we all hate this word, Nehemiah spoke about it in terms of obligation. Not a request. He spoke about it in terms of an obligation, but why? Why did he say that? Because he said by assuming this duty, by fulfilling this obligation, they were not going to allow the house of God to be neglected. And I have great faith and confidence that neither will we. Here's a verse that I came across that I have never seen before in my life that I found it very interesting. In Luke chapter 8, verse 3, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager, and Susanna and many others who provided for them out of their means. Who they provided for was Jesus as he was going around preaching. I'd never thought about Jesus actually needing support. And one of the people that supported him was the wife of the household manager of Herod, the very person who was the enemy of Jesus. I just found that fascinating. But what was fascinating mostly about it is even our Lord was supported as he was walking around on the face of the earth. And people, in this case Joanna, intentionally, along with Susanna, made that happen. So let's just talk about where we are. And I want to thank John has served as the treasurer for many years and recently transitioned this to Ricky. And I want to thank Ricky Dodds for putting this information together. Obviously, Rachel, his PowerPoint knowledge is a lot better than mine. Let's just be blunt about it. The information is not good. We have run a deficit this year. It has not been, this has not been in isolation. Over the last couple of years, we have done this. And you can say, well, shouldn't we just cut our expenses and avoid it? I'll show you a reason why that's not necessarily as easy as it thinks. But as you see there, we are currently running at a $20,800 deficit this year, which means we've had to draw from the reserves that we other had. So the beginning balance at the start of the year was near $38,000, slightly above it. We're now down below $17,000. You see here that on a quarterly basis, our average deficit has been about $5,205. And you'll just see there at the bottom what the statistics show is, you know, we fell short in quarter one by 19%, quarter two by 9%, quarter three by 24%, and through the end of November by 19%. But it's been averaging about $5,000. And this is how it's reflected on a monthly basis, where the average monthly deficit is about $1,893. We've been able to handle that only because of reserves. And if you'll notice that there's only been 2 months in which we've actually been in the black. Very close in June, but other months have been much worse than that. And one of the things you go, well, obviously, there's things that we should just cut and not do. Well, the bulk, 97% of our costs are fixed, meaning it's largely building and salaries, but also utilities. You would be shocked at how much our utilities and our telephone. John's nodding his head because he had paid the bills. We, for instance, how many phone lines do we have to have, John? Three? We have to have three phone lines here because of the security system and internet, things like that. Lawn service, if we all want to get our mowers out on a Saturday morning, I guess we could cut that expense, but I don't think any of us necessarily want to do that. The point of all of it is it's expensive, and I hope that you think we're not being extravagant in the way in which we run the operation of the church, but the fact is our costs are fixed and we've not been meeting the obligations to do that. To be perfectly blunt, if the trend continues, we're out of money in October. I hate to say that, but let's just put it out there. Now, I also know that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. The one thing this congregation has done extraordinarily well over the years was to respond to need. And Dwayne and Sandy and I talk about a lot, how much do you talk about this? Because on one hand, the last thing I want to do is for people to fear coming to church because, oh no, here's one more discussion about money. But maybe we haven't talked about it enough. And if we haven't, we apologize. We know everybody in here can handle the information there, so there it is. All of the treasurer's reports are available to you. We want you to see where money is being spent. We want you to understand how it comes in. Now, we also know that everybody is in a different situation. And remember, the giver in the Bible who is commended above every person was the one who gave the least. I'm not encouraging you to give the least. But what I'm saying is it's not about amount. It's about attitude. We all need to do better. I need to do better. So I know that we will. But I ask you to look at this candidly and honestly, think seriously about it. Any question you have, talk to one of us. We'll answer them, but let's be realistic with where we're at. 2017 can and will be better because we want it to be. The beauty of an organization like this is that we have a spiritual foundation that has not only stood this test of time, but it's from God. The success depends on us. It doesn't depend on other factors. It depends on us, what we want to do, and how we're going to do it. So as we approach the end of this year and think about the beginning of next year, think about ways in which you can really become personally engaged and involved in a way perhaps that you haven't been before, and let's make it a better year for 2017. As we get ready to close here, I'll just mention that someone anticipated the sermon already this morning. Alberta Hips, one of our newest members, came up and asked this morning about, you know, is there a group that regularly meets for people over 55? And I said, well, we've had some efforts like that. Well, Alberta has volunteered to start that effort. So thank you, Alberta and Frank, for volunteering, and she'll put that together. Since I'm only 1 year away from that, I'm feeling, well, good, I'll have a place to go. But a great volunteer effort without even knowing that's what we were going to talk about, so thank you. All right, as we end this service, please take it seriously, as I know you will. Please take it realistically. Take it optimistically, though. Take it optimistically because, again, all of this is within our control. I remember I was at a meeting recently of a board that I sat on, and the entire board was sitting around saying, we need to do this, but we can't because our bylaws say that. And this conversation went on for about an hour, and I finally raised my hand and said, you realize that we write the bylaws, right? If we want to do that, I move that we do that and change the bylaws. And everybody goes, really? You know, I went to law school for some reason, I guess. I said, yes, we're in control of this. Now, we're not going to do anything unscriptural. We may do things differently, but we're not going to do anything unscriptural. The point is, it's in our control. Guided by the Word of God and God Himself, we can do so much. And I hope in 2017 we find ourselves doing that. We're going to offer an invitation now in our closing song, and if anyone needs to respond to that, we encourage you to do that. But let's look forward to a very good 2017 that I know that we can have. Let's stand and sing.